to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we offer you one of the best of Talking History, or at least one of the most popular programs of the past year. We titled the show Ladies' Rights. It aired the week of September 15, 2003, and included an interview Fred Nielsen did with Linda Kerber on her book, No Constitutional Right to Be Ladies. We take up the program with Joey Skidmore's This Week in History.
This Week in History, on September 17, 1978, the Camp David Accords were signed after 12 days of intense negotiations between Egyptian President Anwar el-Sadat and Israeli President Menachem Begin. The negotiations took place at Camp David, the Maryland retreat of United States President Jimmy Carter. The accords led to a final peace agreement signed by Sadat and Begin on March 29, 1979, the first such agreement between Israel and an Arab neighbor. On October 6, 1973, significantly Yom Kippur, the holiest day for Jews, Egyptian and Syrian forces launched a surprise attack on Israel. Israel prevailed, but it took what came to be known as shuttle diplomacy, involving U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, to secure a ceasefire. In recognition of their work on the Camp David Accords, Sadat and Begin were both awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, researchers working in Ethiopia say they found the direct ancestors of humanity, skull bones showing the last evolutionary step before anatomically modern people appeared about 115,000 years ago. The fossil skulls of two adults and one child represent a subspecies of Homo sapiens and may help end an argument about the relationship between modern man and ancient Neanderthals. As we've reported on this show, for decades anthropologists have debated whether Neanderthals contributed to human ancestry or an offshoot that left no heirs in the world today. The new discovery adds weight to the out-of-Africa theory that modern people evolved in Africa and migrated to Europe where they replaced Neanderthals. And this may be the 75th anniversary of sliced bread, if you believe one claimant to the distinction. It's the greatest thing since sliced bread, the ultimate reference to innovative achievement, may trace its origin to Chillicothe, Missouri, where on July 7, 1928, the local newspaper announced that the Chillicothe Baking Company was marketing wrapped loaves of sliced bread. The Post is not without its challengers, including historians of Battle Creek, Michigan, the nation's bread capital. But so far, no one has been able to produce any evidence that they sliced bread earlier. The first bread slicing machine no longer exists. All we have is the newspaper ad. So stay tuned for updates on the battle over sliced bread. This is Talking History. Guest this week, Linda Kerber, may be the most accomplished women's historian in the United States. Her recent book, however, No Constitutional Right to Be Ladies, raises some unusual questions. Here to pose those questions to Professor Kerber is Talking History's Fred Nielsen, Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
America's secular creed, expressed in the Declaration of Independence, is that all men are created equal and possess certain inalienable rights. Yet our focus on individual rights often leads us to forget that as citizens, Americans have certain responsibilities, too. As my guest Linda Kerber suggests, the claim that women have fewer obligations to the state than men, a claim not always borne out in fact, has often led to women possessing fewer rights than men possess in American democracy. Linda Kerber is a professor of history at the University of Iowa and a former president of the Organization of American Historians. Her most recent book is No Constitutional Right to Be Ladies, Women and the Obligations of Citizenship. Professor Kerber, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Although rights and obligations are both part of being a citizen, Americans tend to think more about the one than the other. If there were a Bill of Obligations in the Constitution comparable to the Bill of Rights, what would it look like?
Well, first, I think we should feel very happy that we don't have a Bill of Obligations. Be very skeptical of countries that take care to spell out your obligations to the state. So I think it's a great advantage that we don't have that list. But we do have an unspoken list that is very real and that has been forcefully imposed on all citizens by the state. Two of these obligations are negative obligations. The first, I think everybody knows, we don't think we can define what loyalty is, so we don't so much say that people have an obligation to be loyal as we have an obligation to refrain from treason. There's also another negative obligation, which is the obligation not to be a vagrant. This is an obligation you don't really know you have. It's an obligation to look as though you're working, and you don't know that you haven't fulfilled it until the strong arm of the law grabs you by the shoulder when you're hanging out at a street corner and says you're a vagrant, and we've got vagrancy laws around here. There are three more obligations which are more general and straightforward. There's an obligation to pay taxes, there's an obligation to serve on juries, and there is an obligation to serve in the military.
When the Constitution was written, and also into the 19th century, women's obligations were often understood to be different than men's. Why was this so?
When the Constitution was written, the founding generation, which was very radical in its reconceptualization of the relationship of subject to the state, throwing out the idea of king and subject, replacing it with the radical new idea of sovereign citizens, was also very conservative in maintaining in the new regime two aspects of the old regime that they thought would stabilize it. They bring into the new world their old system of slavery. They strengthen it. They establish it through the two-thirds rule in the Constitution, the fugitive slave law. And they also bring into the new state the old law of domestic relations. And that assumption provided that at marriage, the husband got absolute access to the body of his wife. Well, if you have absolute access to the body of your wife, then it seemed to follow that men would have absolute access to their property and ultimately to their will. You don't let a married woman vote because it's going to give two votes to her husband. And so women enter the new American Republic differently situated than men do.
Their primary obligation then becomes almost more to their husbands than to the state. Would that be fair?
Exactly.
Your book is filled with feisty women of all sorts. Perhaps none are feistier than two sisters after the Civil War, Abby and Julia Smith, who decide even though they pay taxes, they won't pay them. Their justification is that taxation without representation is tyranny. Where have we heard that before?
Exactly. They are absolutely wonderful. They are elderly women. They are unmarried. They pay the highest taxes in their little town outside of Hartford. And it is 1873, which is the 100th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. All around them, people are saying no taxation without representation. And they say, well, if there's no taxation without representation, and we can't vote, why are we paying the highest taxes in town? So they refuse to pay their taxes. The sheriff comes and seizes their cows and takes the cows to be sold at auction on a crossroads, Abby and Julia Smith get into their wagon and have themselves drawn to the crossroads to observe the auctioning off of their cows, shaming everybody into recognition of what they're doing. And then ultimately they go on speaking tours and become something of heroines of the women's rights movement, articulating very clearly that they are being denied equal protection of the laws.
On what basis can a state that extracts the highest number of taxes from these women deny them the right to vote?
Well, it's very interesting, and it was for me a key moment of understanding the difference between our mythologies and our practice. Because after all, no taxation without representation is the key thing we teach our kids. The first political lesson that young kids learn is often circulating around the Boston Tea Party. They know when you get mad, you dump the tea in the Boston Harbor, and you say no taxation without representation. What happens in the aftermath of Abby and Julia Smith's protest is that some of the early legal treatises that are just starting to come out in the 1870s start to have sections about taxation. And these sections translate, not using the legal language here, but they translate as, some people think that taxation is linked to representation. No, no, no. Taxation is part of state power and state authority. And those who live in a state have implicitly agreed to follow, to be guided by and to be under the authority of the state. And so actually, we don't live under a rule of no taxation without representation, and taxation is an imposition of state power. And I believe that that is true of all of those obligations. We like to talk about them as though they are reciprocal, but there is an iron hand in that velvet glove, and Abby and Julia Smith discovered it.
The right to vote for women finally comes in the form of a constitutional guarantee, the suffrage amendment in 1920, which gives women the right to vote, but interestingly doesn't do a lot more. They still don't have the right to serve on juries, for example. The longest section in your book, about a third of it, yeah, is devoted to the struggle which continues for more than half a century after the 19th Amendment to put women in the jury box. What in the world took so long, and how was their exclusion justified?
I think one reason is that by the time when the vote was authorized, there were a lot of people who wanted to be sure that its impact would be very narrow. There was one thing that opponents of suffrage and supporters of suffrage had agreed on, which was that the vote for women would change the world. In fact, it doesn't, and the reason it doesn't is because it would be so narrowly construed. And it comes as a surprise to many people to find that the vote did not automatically get interpreted to mean political rights in general. In some states, for example, it needed a special act of the state legislature to permit women to serve in the state legislature. And the first woman, for example, does not serve in the Iowa legislature until 1929. In some states, where the jury service statutes were written in terms of electors, women get to serve on the on juries almost immediately. But in other states, they don't. And it will take argument and struggle and bitter fight, state by state, region by region, all the way into our own time. Very few people are aware that it is not until 1975 that the Supreme Court ruled for the first time that men's names and women's names must be put in the jury box on the same terms. And it doesn't rule until 1994 that peremptory challenges cannot be used on the basis of gender. So I think that we've underestimated how narrow the interpretation of the Voting Rights Amendment was. I think that one reason for that resistance, and it's very severe, is that in a jury, women get to judge other people. They judge men. In the attacks on women on juries, one constant theme is, imagine a jury mostly or fully composed of women who will decide to send a man to the electric chair. Are you willing to live with that? So it's one thing to permit women to be part of the voice of the American people, which is what voting does. It's quite another thing to acknowledge that women's judgment might be as reliable and trustworthy as men's judgment, and I think that's the issue there.
Some have argued for a long time that one of the prime advantages of being a lady and thus being treated differently under the law, as you describe in your book, is that women, unlike men, are not obligated to military service. In legal terms, what has been the disadvantage for women in not being soldiers?
The first thing I need to say is that American draft law generally starts with an opening statement that says something like, whereas all citizens are obliged to defend the country. So that theoretically, the point has been established in American law and jurisprudence, at least since the 1920s, that should the time come that Congress wishes to draft women, it could. The theoretical grounds that people think have been reliably established are not there to protect women against a draft. Congress has not chosen to draft women, but it could. When I think about the usefulness of drafting women, I don't have any good answers. I myself resist the draft in general. I'm skeptical of it. But when you think of the draft as a metaphor for using violence in defense of the state and who is trained to defend the state, who is trained to use violence in defense of state authority, then I think it becomes much less defensible to train only one half the population to defend the state with force and train the other half of the population to be incompetent in its use. In a hearing on women in the military, Judy Goldsmith, who was then president of the National Organization for Women, observed that she thought that men who stalked women, attackers, rapists, people like that, might think twice if they realized or they had reason to assume that any woman they went after was likely to have had 6 weeks of basic training. So I think what your question raises is the large question of who do we trust to use power in defense of state goals.
Obviously, the things that you're talking about are not only of historical interest, that is, not only are they placed in the past, they're clearly issues of present concern and concern for the future as well. I wonder, in the light of that, and in light of the fact that your book can be read in part at least as being framed as a response to contemporary concerns about the constitutional place of ladies, what is the role, or what ought to be the role, of a historian in entering contemporary political and legal debates?
I think that historians have been thinking, certainly I've been thinking in this book, a great deal about the relationship of women to the state and the obligations and claims that states can make on women, the obligations that states have toward women. One upshot of insisting that women and violence didn't go together for many years was the denial of the force and extensiveness of domestic violence in our country, and a denial that women needed to be able to defend themselves. In the aftermath of 9/11, we have been thinking, had reason to think very hard, not only about the presence of violence in the world, but about the absence of American response to the attacks on and the oppression of women in Afghanistan and other parts of the world because they were not part of our vision of what went on outside the boundaries of the United States. So I think that a knowledge of American complex understandings of the relationship of women to men can help us get our bearings in the way in which we respond to issues like issues of violence abroad, to our understanding of rape as a war crime, to our willingness to include women among decision makers and possessors of power and authority in the present.
Well, Professor Kerber, thanks for visiting with us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Linda Kerber, the author of No Constitutional Right to Be Ladies, Women and the Obligations of Citizenship.
Continuing on our subject of women's history, we've selected for our site of the week a new women's museum called An Institute for the Future. As the title suggests, and Talking History's Fiona Beatty explains, it's a bit different from your traditional historical museum.
The Women's Museum aims to celebrate the accomplishments of American women, but it also pledges to convince visitors that you too can accomplish something in your life. The $30 million Smithsonian-affiliated museum is credited with being a forerunner, a benchmark against which other emerging women's museums planned for San Francisco, New York, and Washington will be measured. Each will offer a somewhat different twist on women's issues, but all will follow what is considered to be this new paradigm in museum design.
And finally, as promised, Henry Butterfield Ryan returns to Talking History to give us his insights on American plans to establish a democracy in post-war Iraq. Ryan is a retired Foreign Service officer, now an historian associated with the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University and with Claire Hall at Cambridge University.
U.S. policymakers, with almost brilliant naivete, marched American troops into Iraq. Partially, they say, to establish democracy there and also in nearby autocracies, using mind-numbing phrases like the architecture of a forward force posture, they fumbled America into a dangerous and complicated situation. So now our commitment may well require not just the small force for a matter of months, as originally planned, but a much larger one for an indefinite period, including reservists and National Guard units, at a cost of $4 billion a month. What happened? Well, whatever else, the administration obviously deluded itself with inappropriate words and the ideas they conjured, especially liberation. It brought to mind images of victorious Allied troops marching into Europe at the end of World War II, and it was meant to. Even before shooting began, the Iraqi adventure was suffused with World War II imagery. But the Europe we liberated in the 1940s suffered under foreign occupation. Iraq was ruled by Iraqis, despicable Iraqis indeed, but homeboys nonetheless. They emerged from the country's political environment. And therein lay another deception. The idea that if we simply removed Saddam Hussein, democracy would burst out like azalea blossoms in springtime, just as in Western Europe after Hitler. That idea blithely ignored the fact that, unlike Europe, Iraq had no significant experience with democracy. Saddam Hussein may have been its very worst ruler, but neither he nor his Ba'ath party introduced vicious politics to that country. Iraq was created after World War I. The British, who controlled it under a League of Nations mandate until 1932, tried to create a constitutional parliamentary government. But all that was dismantled after they left. Since then, Iraqi politics have been characterized by constant armed clashes between tribes, religious factions, political groups, and hostile regions. Americans have toddled into this environment like babes in the woods, chattering about liberation, freedom, and democracy. Our best hope now is to internationalize the occupation, but that is complicated by the Bush administration's reluctance to relinquish overall control. So next time you hear someone from Washington using phrases like the architecture of forward force posture, call the police. That person may not be just torturing the language. He or she may be leading our country into another quagmire.
You've been listening to Henry Butterfield Ryan, retired Foreign Service officer, now an historian associated with the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University and with Claire Hall at Cambridge University. Ryan's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer.
And I'd like to offer a correction to last week's site of the week. If you're interested in learning more about film and history, Ken Burns's work in particular, you should check out the summer 2002 issue of the Magazine of History, available from oah.org. We erroneously reported it was in the summer 2003 issue.
And until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.